Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, brought to you by AS21 Audio. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
So I have a friend who used to tell me, exasperated with my tendency to do this, that there are two types of people in the world. Those who don't divide the world into two types of people and those who do. So I'm going to start by doing something I used to do in my class, which I affectedly call dualities. Now, the reason I call them dualities is because of that I believe more than anything else, it's the divided self, the tensions between our ideals and our realities that create new and better thoughts. Think of it like this. Every thesis has an antithesis. Every pleasant fantasy has a nightmarish mirror image. Every person has a mother and a father. So dividing the world into two camps can obviously be a very dangerous slippery slope. And if we indulge in what's generally referred to as dialectical thinking, it's very important to understand that this is a pseudoscience. It can never be anything more than an intellectual game, which we can use to theorize about the world. And there's no scientific value to it without going through the exact same process scientists do of thousands of trials and errors through which recorded data and statistics are registered. Now, sometimes there aren't even two sides to every issue. Sometimes there are three or four. So sometimes there will be trialities or quadralities, and sometimes the opposing point of view is based on bull, so we're going to call that monalities. So here are the six dualities. First duality, venial sins versus mortal sins. Second duality, divine reliance versus self-reliance. Third duality, virtue versus fortune, or to use Machiavelli's terminology, virtù versus fortuna. Fourth duality, Machiavelli to save lives versus Machiavelli to take lives. Fifth duality, the time of troubles versus the Great Depression. Sixth duality, American suffering versus world suffering. So let's get to our first duality. Now, I joked with my producer and editor this week that one out of every five of these podcasts would be about The Godfather, and the editor told me he had no idea if I was serious or not, but he was behind the idea. Now, I'm pretty sure that in the last podcast, I completely forgot to talk about the core of The Godfather's appeal. Core is this. It's the key movie, one of the key works of art ever made in any form or time period, that explains to us the appeal, the inevitability, the temptation, perhaps even the necessity of evil. Now, evil will always be with us. Everything that's created will be destroyed. Every morally good objective in life requires some things or actions along the way to wade into, to say the least, that are moral gray areas. Now, if the world is already filled with murderers, let me ask, do we simply work to make a world without unjust murders and all the nearly as grisly things that accompany it? And if we do, what are we prepared to do to make it happen? If we're on the right wing of the political spectrum, are we prepared to advocate for authoritarian methods? If we're on the left wing of the political spectrum, are we prepared to advocate for terrorist methods? And if those methods fail to rid the world of murder, are we prepared to take those matters into our own hands and be the change we wish to see in the world? Or do we just shrug and accept that injustice is just part of the world that we can't change? Certainly the latter path is easier, which means that most people will choose it over the former path, which makes life for those who choose the former path of activism will become that much more exponentially difficult. So if, as statistics tell us, 1%, a full 1% of the population is psychopaths, if 4% of the population is sociopaths, if 7 or 8% of the population have narcissistic tendencies, wouldn't it stand to reason that we should make one in every 100 decisions just to protect ourselves the way a psychopath would make them, 4 in every 100 the way a sociopath would, and we'll get into the distinctions between the two, no doubt, in some other podcast. And maybe we should act narcissistically 7 or 8% of the time. We'd still be acting ethically nearly 90% of the time, which I think is more than most people act ethically in every 100 choices that they make. But at least we know which choices we are making the morally bad choices in, and at least we know that we ourselves would be harder to exploit. But once you taste from the tree of knowledge, it's impossible to go back to naivete. When you free yourself from ethical considerations, it becomes much easier, perhaps much more pleasant, to live life than it was when you were concerned about ethics. Now, no matter how Catholics or ex-Catholics think of the Church's stance on various sins, there's a reason Catholics talk about venial sins as well as mortal sins. And at the end of the day, if you try to remember detail by detail all the sins you committed over the course of a day, I doubt any person could get through a single day of their life without committing a dozen venial sins. But when one comes to rely on these sins rather than do one's best to avoid them, one becomes in danger of committing much, much worse acts. But it still remains true, in order to live through our days, we have to sin. And the more we sin, the more we find it easy to thrive. Those who truly thrive in life are usually not the best of us. There are, of course, many exceptions, but if the idea of living your life in a moral gray area that it takes to achieve great success fills you with excitement, you're probably not the person we can best rely on to look after anyone's interests but your own. But there do exist people of means and power who genuinely care about those who are under them. And through the last 200 or so years, there have been Washingtons and Lincolns and Roosevelts and Johnsons and Clemenceaus and Gladstones and Attlees and Brandts and Nehrus and Ben-Gurions and, of course, Mandelas, who used the levers of power, often truly destructive levers, to the purposes of making good changes in the lives of millions that last longer than they would if they were made in an exclusively good way. And while these men in history are rare, the fact remains that because they backed up their good with the capacity to do evil, the manner in which they helped people is far longer lasting. Even a famous socialist like the 1930s French Prime Minister Léon Blum delayed helping the Spanish Republicans for years because he knew that the sooner he got involved, the easier the fascists would find it in France to depose him and his reforms, and that in itself could cause a French civil war. As it happened, his reforms after Vichy fell were reinstated, and they exist in France for the most part to this day, if they have not been extended. And this is during a period when conservative rule in France has been paramount for the better part of 70 years, and no conservative has been able to get rid of Blum's reforms. So they did what they thought was necessary to extend human rights to people who had none, these leaders of generosity. But in doing so, they let the more squeamish souls under them wring their hands about the consequences. And this ultimately brings us to our second duality, divine reliance versus self-reliance. And here is our first quote about Machiavelli. This is obviously from The Prince. "It is necessary, therefore, if we discuss the matter thoroughly, to inquire whether these innovators can rely on themselves or have to depend on others. That is to say, whether to consume their enterprise, they have to use prayers, or can they use force? In the first instance, they always succeed badly and never compass anything, but when they can rely on themselves and use force, then they are rarely endangered. Hence, it is all armed prophets have conquered and unarmed ones have been destroyed. Besides the reasons mentioned, the nature of the people is variable, and whilst it is easy to persuade them, it is difficult to fix them in that persuasion. And thus it is necessary to take such measures that, when they believe no longer, it may be possible to make them believe by force." When you rebel against something so long entrenched, and nothing in human history was so entrenched as the medieval church, you can only rebel by turning the ideas you resent against themselves. When the human mind wasn't advanced enough to think of the self apart from being a creation of God, it could only achieve self-reliance in terms of the most atrocious sinning, and the sins can only be committed by the world's most powerful people, who are the nearest human incarnations to God that the people surrounding them can conceive. Humanity was only emerging from the Middle Ages. Murder in the name of crime or the state was a terrible sin. But murder in the name of the church was to save souls. And what is loss of life in this world compared to the eternal rewards you might gain in heaven? Now, Machiavelli was a contemporary of Martin Luther, and the greater notions of free will, so much beloved of Protestants, were only really beginning to marinate in the human mind. 150 years later, John Milton would express this notion still much better than Machiavelli or I ever could. Free will would still be couched in sin, but this most religious of poets would make Satan into his most interesting and beloved character in his famous epic poem, Paradise Lost. So think of these famous lines from Paradise Lost and how they elucidate this concept of Machiavelli, of self-reliance rather than divine reliance. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. What matter where, if I be still the same, and what should I be, all but less than he whom thunder hath made greater? Here at least we shall be free, the Almighty hath not built. Here for his envy will not drive us hence. Here we may reign secure, and in my choice, to reign is worth ambition, though in hell, better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. I think you get the sense here of what we're talking about, that self-reliance is, in a sense, at this point in history, a rebellion against God, but it is at the same time the next evolutionary step. And this brings us to our third duality, virtue versus fortune, or to use Machiavelli's terminology, virtù versus fortuna. Now, one does not want to traffic in stereotypes, and yet when we're talking about how linguistic meanings have changed, we have to talk about inner lives, about differences not only of historical periods, but of geographic spaces as well. The Northern European philosophical terminologies that we generally think of today with their heavy metaphysics was only beginning at this point in history with Luther, before the individual could be saved by faith alone. So the individual's consciousness and the troubles of one's conscience were not nearly as important as the priestly absolution of it. Your ethical actions, your inner experiences, they belong to God from birth to death. You are literally a manifestation of God and not your own being. So the only part of you which belongs to you was your sensuality, that part of God which is forbidden. But because it was so forbidden, maybe the urges to sensual pleasure felt that much more powerful. And so virtù in this case does not mean Christian virtue, but classical virtue. Let me explain. Every person who's studied a bit of classical music knows the term virtuoso. And that doesn't mean anything ethical. It means something much closer to a mastery of dexterity rather than anything having to do with good behavior. And fortuna does not mean Christian fortune, which in all fortune that matters in Christianity is the fortune of salvation versus the fortune of damnation or perdition. But classical fortune, the wheel of fate, which always shifts and arbitrarily distributes good luck and bad luck. So what matters to Machiavelli is the dexterity to stay a balance in circumstances of fortune that are always shifting. It's as though thinking before Machiavelli was just in basic geometric shapes. And with Machiavelli, we're now thinking in fractals. Now, not being a mathematician, I'm going to leave the definition of fractals to the internet in some odd website that calls itself the Fractal Foundation. So, this is the Fractal Foundation's definition of fractals. A fractal is a never-ending pattern. Fractals are infinitely complex patterns that are self-similar across different scales. They are created by repeating a simple process over and over in an ongoing feedback loop. Driven by recursion, fractals are images of dynamic systems, the pictures of chaos. Geometrically, they exist between our familiar dimensions. Fractal patterns are extremely familiar since nature is full of fractals, for instance, trees, rivers, coastlines, mountains, clouds, seashells, hurricanes, etc. Now, from a physical standpoint, fractals are the diverse and many, far too many to count, geometric patterns that produce nature. If you take this from a metaphysical standpoint, fractals are literally the order that is so complex that it seems like chaos. And what better definition of nature can there be than that? It shouldn't come as a surprise. We're talking about fractals, and Machiavelli, with this sort of chaos, comes about in the Renaissance, in the exact same period as we are finally figuring out for sure that the geocentric universe is not, in fact, the way the universe operates. And there is no stationary plan for the universe. There is merely a chaos of constantly moving objects. So in Machiavelli, we are seeing this political, constantly shifting universe, these political fractals, you know, these weird cosmological shapes by which the most gifted politicians know exactly when and how to strike and when and how to wait. So consider this quote about the four ancients whom Machiavelli considers the greatest men in history. And let's note, as the historian Hugh Trevor Roper did, that they were all at very least semi-mythological. In examining their actions and lives, one cannot see that they owed anything to fortune beyond opportunity, which brought them the material to mold into the form which seemed best to them. Without that opportunity, their powers of mind would have been extinguished, and without those powers, the opportunity would have come in vain. It was necessary, therefore, to Moses that he should find the people of Israel in Egypt enslaved and oppressed by the Egyptians, in order that they should be disposed to follow him so as to be delivered out of bondage. It was necessary that Romulus should not remain in Alba, and that he should be abandoned at his birth in order that he should become king of Rome and founder of the fatherland. It was necessary that Cyrus should find the Persians discontented with the government of Medes, and the Medes soft and effeminate through their long peace. Theseus could not have shown his ability had he not found the Athenians dispersed. These opportunities, therefore, made those men fortunate, and their high ability enabled them to recognize the opportunity whereby their country was ennobled and made famous. Fortune has to favor people in order to become successful, but they need the virtue, or more to the point, the virtuosity, to know exactly how to exploit fortune to their advantage, so that when they are down on their luck, they know how to climb back up. Consider the mythical leader my generation considers to be our modern Moses or Theseus, Barack Hussein Obama. We're not even going to talk about the circumstances of his early life, but conventional wisdom dictated that he would lose to Hillary Clinton in 2008, but that he was well disposed to be a presidential candidate in 2016 or 2012. But President Obama knew the truth of Democratic presidential candidates from time immemorial. Democrats fall in love, not in line, and you have to run when you're still mysterious and don't have a long track record to pin yourself down upon in the liberal imagination, before which your record can be hair split into shreds. And this is why Hillary Clinton lost twice. Had she run in 2004 when her political career was new and shiny, who knows, she might have won. John Kerry was considered similarly bright and shiny in 2000, and he was the dream candidate everybody longed for against the two worn and well-known Al Gore and Bill Bradley. Al Gore was considered such a candidate in 1992, one of a half dozen who could have beaten the then little-known Bill Clinton. But President Clinton, like President Obama, knew that familiarity only works to the favor of conservatives. Among the temperamentally progressive, fortune favors the barely known. The exciting newcomer who can conjure the ideas of untried possibilities is whom progressives go for. So both Clinton and Obama exploited not just political chaos, but the longing for political chaos to become the closest thing America has to a prince. So here's Machiavelli again. Those who acquire by various ways become princes like these men acquire a principality with difficulty, but they keep it with ease. The difficulties they have in acquiring it arise in part from the new rules and methods which they are forced to introduce and to establish their government and its security. And it ought to be remembered that there is nothing more difficult to take in hand, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain of its success than to take lead in introduction of the new order of things, because the innovator has for enemies all those who have done well under old conditions and lukewarm defenders under those who may do well under the new. This coolness arises in part from the incredulity of men who do not readily believe new things until they have long experience of them. Thus it happens that whenever those who are hostile have the opportunity to attack, they do it like partisans, whilst the others defend lukewarmly in such wise that the prince is endangered with them. Now, I saw a Canadian documentary about Machiavelli from the 90s in which it was claimed that the 90s were a particularly Machiavellian era because Bill Clinton was president. Now, the 90s were about as un-Machiavellian era as an era can possibly get. The reason to use comparisons from recent history is that in everyone's memory, every era is a Machiavellian era. What changes from era to era is not the rules, but the stakes. And compared to Machiavelli's own time and place, the stakes of politics in ours are, even in the era of Trump, relatively low. So this brings us to the next duality, Machiavelli to save lives and Machiavelli to take lives. And bear in mind the quote we just heard. We'll get to talking about how Machiavelli is used to take people's lives later, but for the moment, let's just talk about how Machiavelli's tactics were used to save lives. Particularly, we're going to talk for a moment about the Obamacare debate and how Machiavelli seemed to see it all coming. He saw the vituperation against it, he saw the half-hearted defenses by the people who supported it, and he saw the unbelievable miracle it seemed in 2010 that Obamacare passed at all, and all the Machiavellian things that Obama and company had to do to pass it. Now, from the very beginning of the healthcare debate, the process was nearly impossible. Merely to get universal healthcare on the table, Obama pulled his first Machiavelli card out by ditching his single-payer healthcare promise from the 08 campaign. Single-payer is the process by which healthcare would be nationalized and paid entirely through taxes. In 2008, single-payer healthcare was an absolute impossibility in America, and those who believed it could have been used even as a bargaining chip were completely out of touch with reality. Obama came to office with a, it's true, 60-seat supermajority in the Senate. Now, holding 60 seats in the Senate, of the Senate's 100 seats, is of paramount importance all the time, because a three-fifths majority can end any attempt at a filibuster, which is the process through which any one senator can stymie all progress in the Senate, and therefore all progress in the government. But even with what was technically a supermajority, the Democratic coalition was anything but monolithic. Even if the Democratic Party was even more fractious in many other eras, it still remains true that Lyndon Johnson had a supermajority of 68 seats in 1965, and Franklin Roosevelt's supermajority was 77 Senate seats in 1937. Furthermore, in the 2000s, congressional Republicans were a monolithic coalition as no political party has ever been in the entire history of the country. Famously termed by the Time journalist Michael Grunwald, the party of no. When it came time for the first Obamacare vote in the House, 39 Democrats voted against it, and one Republican voted for it. And then came the crushing and hugely symbolic death of Ted Kennedy, who made better health care the fight of his career. And he died without seeing it reality, and he ruined the Democrats' 60-seat supermajority. For the moment, Kennedy's seat was filled by Paul Kirk, a former Democratic National Committee chairman, but Kennedy's death entailed a special election to elect a new senator. So then came Obama's next and most important Machiavellian move. On Christmas Eve 2009, the Senate voted on their version of the Obamacare bill, the quote-unquote Healthy Future Act, and its author was Max Baucus of Montana. Baucus was the moderate, if not downright conservative Democrat who was the party's greatest opponent to the bill. He called Obamacare a train wreck that would be hell for small business owners. And Baucus had taken more than $5 million in campaign contributions from various health industries. Now, how did Obama get Baucus to author this bill? Well, it's because the bill did not even have so much as a public option. It was a dirty, underhanded, disgusting way of privatizing universal health care that let insurance companies make even more money off the suffering of the American people like vultures, and it may have saved 50 million American lives. In any event, the ditching of the public option might have been an astonishing stroke of good luck, because just in case there was any chance at all that the public option could have been reinstated, Scott Brown, an undistinguished, little-known Republican state senator, won a special election to replace Ted Kennedy in Massachusetts against the heavily favored Democrat, the Attorney General for the state, Martha Coakley. Now, had the public option been on the table, the Senate might have filibustered the entirety of Obamacare into oblivion. Now, it was basically Baucus's money grab of an insurance bill that went to the House, and even in the House, it only passed by 7 votes. 34 Democrats voted against the bill in the House, and not a single Republican voted for it. Not a single one. Just 7 votes after a year and a half of painstaking, dirty compromise, and somehow the majority of progressives in this country still think Obama sold them out. Machiavelli would have seen this coming too. But this is how Machiavelli sometimes saves lives, and saved lives he most certainly has many times. Every era, every effective political action, no matter how good or bad, is Machiavellian. But yes, some eras are more Machiavellian than others. Few ages, of course, were more Machiavellian than the time and place in which Machiavelli lived. The brutal rules of what creates common good came to him in an age of chaos, betrayal, and brutality. And perhaps we'll talk about more about that era next week. But in the meantime, let's talk about a more Machiavellian time and place than 2017 and even 2017 America. That time and place is the Russia of the 1990s with our next duality, the time of troubles versus the Great Depression. It's not like America has never known its share of suffering, but when you compare the two countries, well, you can't. You just can't compare the two countries. There is absolutely no comparison in what Russians have suffered through their history and what Americans have in ours. Russia has always referred to a fearful time of troubles in the early 17th century, which saw a famine that killed off a third of the population from starvation and cold, and then a war with Poland, which killed tens of thousands, including the massacre of thousands in Moscow itself. So imagine for a moment how Russians must have felt when many of them began referring to the 1990s as their second time of troubles. Now, the exaggeration in this term is fairly obvious. This country, Russia, which lost 27 million people in World War II and something like 40 million to Stalin, had experienced much, much worse suffering than the 1990s in their own lifetimes. Russia's worries were not akin to the time of troubles or even to World War II or the Great Terror. But small sufferings feel, I believe, far more acute than life-threatening ones. Because when you're not worried for your survival, all that remains is that palpable sense of humiliation for having lost, in this case, so many people and decades to communism, only for the losses to have been turned out to be worth nothing. Russia was experiencing its own form of post-traumatic stress. Nevertheless, post-traumatic stress is not the trauma itself, and the trauma just ahead of Russia was bad enough. When we speak of small sufferings, we're still speaking only in relative terms. Because while this was not a second time of troubles in which Russia lost a third of its population, it was nevertheless worse than the Great Depression was in America on its worst day. Losing the Cold War was already humiliating, but then to switch from a centrally planned economy to a market economy with no smooth transition for a soft landing, that was almost unquestionably the greatest failure of Bill Clinton's thoroughly flawed presidency. In 3 years' time, the Russian ruble went from 144 rubles against the dollar to well over 5,000 rubles against the dollar. I remember my family went on a trip when I was a teenager, and in 1999, we were in Odessa, and my dad said, let's get a bottle of champagne, which was rare for him, as he is not the most spendthrift person. And then we found out a bottle of champagne was 75 cents. Now, as far as we know, half of Russia's transactions existed on the black market. Wealth, which is already concentrated by the Communist Party and their secret police, became still more concentrated in the Russian elite than it had been since the era of the Tsars. Party members who controlled various industries became outright owners, as the former party members were the only people who knew how to run the industries. KGB agents became mafiosi and contract killers to eliminate competition. The old Russian joke goes that capitalism is when a man exploits a man, and communism is the other way around. Well, the 1990s in Russia reversed that joke again. The stage was entirely set for a Machiavellian who could ride the chaos of these political fractals into some kind of order. Now, Machiavelli writes, there could never exist in time of war any unexpected circumstances he could not deal with, but to exercise the intellect the prince should read histories and study there the actions of illustrious men, to see how they have borne themselves in war, to examine the causes of their victories and defeat so as to avoid the latter and imitate the former. There was not a single KGB agent who was not educated thoroughly in Machiavelli and in the history of warfare and politics. Putin may not be the political virtuoso he seems to be in 2018, and he certainly didn't look that way before 2016, but he was thoroughly educated in military history in a way that very few American leaders were. And as well-read as Obama was, I can't imagine that Thucydides or Herodotus or Clausewitz or Sun Tzu were very high on his priority list. He might have dabbled, but on the other hand, I'm sure that Eisenhower and Nixon and Truman made it a point of reading as much as possible. In Nixon's case, I'm sure he read every page. So Putin operated at a considerable advantage over the American leaders just by knowing what's worked militarily in history in the more extreme realms of politics and what hasn't worked. So that brings us to the next and final duality, American suffering versus world suffering. Now, nearly everywhere else in the world, even the most prosperous people in the world know what it means for the country itself to break. They know what it means to be so cold and so hungry in living memory that their children would cry all day and all night, and at times the only potential relief for the suffering seemed to be to pray for their children's death. Now, every other major world power, Britain, France, Germany, Austria, Russia, China, every single one still knows this suffering at some point in their living memory, however distant. From the bottom of the society to the very top, it affects everyone. It's one thing to live in a societal pyramid as we have in America, where the top still exists, because there at least there's hope that you can reach prosperity. And if that hope is never fulfilled, that can drive a society insane in a completely different way. But then there are the societies for which there is no top at all, and that creates a very different kind of insanity. In a society where the hopes for the prosperity of millions are too long delayed, as they've been in America now for hundreds of years, people can become very soft. In such a society, the biggest faux pas among anybody who has even a small amount of prosperity is a lack of empathy for those who don't. But then there are the societies in which there is no hope at all. And in these societies, people become very hard, because the greatest faux pas among people with a small amount of prosperity is to have any empathy at all. In such a society without hope, empathy is synonymous with weakness. And if a temptation exists in many of us to hate some Americans for not being nearly empathetic enough, it's important to remember that there's still a country on the other side of the world, just as large and consequential as ours, who hates even the least empathetic of us for having the empathy which they lacked and using our empathy to defeat them. And we'll talk more about that in coming weeks, too. It's perfectly legitimate to have any feeling you like about the 2016 election. It's not legitimate, however, to believe at this point that Russia was not involved. People are entitled to their own opinions. They are not entitled to their own facts. And while we're not going to get into any analysis of the election in this episode, to ever say that Russia was not involved in the 2016 election in early 2018 is not just a state of denial. It's a lie. After the 20th century, America was hated by the Soviet Union, not because we were strong, but because we were weak. And the fact that the Soviet Union lost the Cold War to this empire ruled by spoiled children, whom they think never knew a moment's suffering, is to them the ultimate injustice. And what's especially terrifying about this is that they have a point. Roughly 405,000 Americans died in World War II. That's roughly 1 in 395 American citizens of the time. 27 million Soviet citizens died in World War II. 1 in 6. War is hell. War is murder. And to many people in Russia, still, it's clear that America never fought in World War II and just swooped in to steal the spoils. Now, we in America have forgotten just how desperate a place the world can become, and we act as though the world will never again be that way, and certainly won't be for us. But powerful people exist in distant lands who would love nothing more than to make us feel just a fraction of the desperation they are powerless to not bring to their own people, and if possible, much more than that. And they have an entire handbook designed for exactly that purpose, and in order to stop them, we have to operate by that same handbook. But in order to defeat them, we have to use, and have used, a moderated, kinder, updated version of the same handbook. So next week, another episode on Machiavelli, and then, with some breaks for lighter stuff, we'll go on to some liberal thinkers of the 20th century who showed how to use Machiavelli against itself. Not by, as neoconservatives and Leo Strauss did, by trying to subvert Machiavelli, but by trying to incorporate his amorality into a better, longer-lasting morality. This is the morality of Reinhold Niebuhr, Isaiah Berlin, Arthur Schlesinger, Michael Walzer, and so many others. See you next week.
Much of what happened, what is discovered now, will of course be secret.
This has been It's Not Even Past, A History of the Distant Present, hosted by Evan Tucker. This has been a production of the AS21 Podcast Network and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find these and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Copyright 2018, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?